So, okay, we're thinking, and we just think as usual. We think we're going to listen to these teachings, and that includes me, I promise, so that we can take some tools from it, so we can develop our amazing potential, so finally that we can be a... And just say one more time in English, I'll put my, say my own words. We're saying until we are enlightened, we are going to rely upon the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And by the virtue of listening to these teachings, so we can be a benefit to all sentient beings. That's it. Okay. Are we stable still? Everything's okay? Donna? Good, darling. Okay. Delete prayers. Finish prayers. Okay. So, sorry, Venerable, we lost your audio for a moment.
Oh, I don't believe it. She's still having problems.
Donna, can't you hear me? You can't hear me, Donna.
I can hear you now, but I couldn't hear you for a moment. It's coming in and out.
This is no good. We can't continue the class like this. I don't know what else to do. I can't get any other system. I don't know what to say. Is everybody going? Can you take the prayers off, please, so I can see
yes.
people?
Yes.
Okay. Are other people having problems as well? Am I coming? It's no good. I mean, normally I can get another Wi-Fi, but I can't get it today for some reason. I'm using my hotspot, which is what I only ever use.
I don't think it's you. I just think there's something going on.
It's obstacles for us to be communicating. Look at last week, missing you completely. Well, I mean, you're not going to hear me half of what I'm saying. What's the point? You go nuts, you know? You go crazy.
Venerable, one suggestion is to turn off your video and we would just have the teaching on audio. Not as satisfying, but we could hear you at least.
Well, you don't know you can. Let's see. Let's just try it out.
Okay.
Delete the video. Is it any better? Can you hear me any better?
Can hear you fine right now.
Is it better than before?
The only difference is I'm still hearing you consistently, so if it breaks up, I'll let you know.
So you mean you're hearing me now without a break? Is that everybody? Nod or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, if I turn the video on, does it suddenly make it more difficult now, does it? Is it makes it more difficult with the video? It makes it more difficult.
Not right now. It's
not right now.
Now it's consistent.
Well, we'll give it a try. And, Donnie, you be on the case. And if there's a problem.
Okay, you just broke up.
You have to turn your video off. And just use audio. It's because your internet connection is a little weak, so you can only use one or the other.
Well, we don't know that, Lorna. It's possibly it's true, but maybe it's you guys. I mean, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. Just one more thing, and I'll come back to you, okay?
Okay.
Thank you.
I've just had a suggestion, which is exactly what I was thinking. Let's say chara mantras to remove obstacles. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha. 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 Venerable Rubina has returned.
Is this any better? Clearer and better in any way, or is it just the same?
Looks better. Sounds good so far.
Okay. Let's, what about now? Okay, is it working?
Yes.
Seems like a possibility.
Yes.
Working. Okay, good. Let's pray. Okay, let's start. So far, how many classes do we have? One already, isn't it? Or two?
One, yes. This is, we've had one. And you're freezing. Your video's freezing.
Okay, I'll turn the video off. What can we say? So what I'm trying to do here, what I'm trying to do here is...
And Venerable, we can't hear you now.
Oh, Jesus wept. This is a disaster. We've got some obstacles, haven't we? We've really got some obstacles. This never happens in 1.5 years. 1 year, this has never happened. My hotspot works perfectly normally. I don't know what's going on. It's just some obstacles we all have. I don't know what else to say. Maybe we should cancel it until we get a better connection. I don't know what to say. Got any suggestions?
I don't know. I'm sorry, Venerable, can you say again?
So you just have to either hang up, sort of hang around for another 10 minutes and I'll get back to you, okay?
Okay. All right. We have 10 minutes. Let's do praises to the 21 Taras. Give me a moment to get them up. And I'm having a little trouble, so maybe I can get some help with leading it. Maybe we can do it in rounds. Let me just get the file up so we can share the screen and see it. Linda, would you be willing to lead the first round?
I can
try. If that's not good, then Venerable Chuying, how about Linda, you lead the first round and Chuying while you take the second one until Venerable Rubina comes. Is that cool?
If you like, Donna.
Okay, thank you. I'm just having trouble with my voice tonight, so here we are, share screen.
Okay, are we ready?
Yes.
Praises to the 21 Taras. The attitude to have toward Arya Mother Tara while reciting 21 Tara praises is, you know what is best for me. That attitude with devotion, then recite the praises to the 21 Taras. Om I prostrate to the noble transcendent liberator. Homage Tara swift heroic, eyes like lightning instantaneous, sprung from opening stamens of the Lord of Three Worlds to a blooming lotus. Homage she whose face combines a 100 autumn moons at fullest, blazing with light rays resplendent as a 1,000 star collection. Homage golden blue and lotus, waterborn and hand adorned, giving effort, calm austerities, patience, meditation, her sphere. Homage crown of Tathagatas, actions triumph without limit, relied on by conqueror's children, having reached every perfection. Homage filling with Tutare, whom desire direction and space, trampling with her feet the seven worlds, able to draw forth all beings. Homage worshipped by the All Lord, Chakra Agne Brahma Marut, honored by the host of spirits, corpse raisers, Gandharvas, Yakshas. Homage with her trade and faith sounds, destroying foes' magic diagrams, her feet pressing left out right in, blazing in a raging fire blaze. Homage to a very dreadful destroyer of Mara's champions, she with frowning lotus visage, who is slayer of all enemies. Homage at the heart, her fingers adorn her with three jewel mudra, light rays masses all excited, all the directions wheels adorn her. Homage she so joyous, radiant, crown emitting garlands of light, mirthful laughing with Tutare, subjugating Mara's devas. Homage she able to summon all earth guardians assembly, shaking, frowning with her home sign, saving from every misfortune. Homage crown adorned with crescent, moon all ornaments most shiny, Amitabha in her hair knot, sending out much light eternal. Homage she mithritha blaze like eon ending fire abiding, right stress left bent, joy surrounds you, troops of enemies destroying. Homage she who strikes the ground with her palm, and with her foot beats it, scallion with the letter whom the seven levels she does conquer. Homage, happy, virtuous, peaceful, she whose field is peace nirvana, she endowed with omen soha, destroyer of the great evil. Homage, she with joy surrounded, tearing foes' bodies asunder, freeze with home and knowledge mantra, arrangement of the 10 letters, homage to Ray with seed letter, of the shape of syllable home, by foot stamping shakes the three worlds, Meru, Mandara, and Vindhya, homage holding in her hand the hair marked moon of Deva lake form, with high spoken Tara and fate, totally dispelling poison, homage she whom gods and their kings and the Kanaras do honor, armored in all joyful splendor. She dispels bad dreams and conflicts. Donna, can you? Is she whose ties bright with radiance of sun and full moon, with twice Hara and Tutare, she dispels severe contagion. Homage full of liberating power by the set of three natures, destroys a host of spirits, yakshas, and raise corpses supreme Tare. These praises with the root mantras and prostrations thus are 21.
Om, I prostrate to the noble transcendent liberator. Homage, Tara, swift, heroic, eyes like lightning instantaneous, sprung from opening stamens of the Lord of Three Worlds, Tirban Lotus. Homage, she whose face combines 100 autumn moons at fullest, blazing with light rays resplendent as a 1,000-star collection. Homage, golden blue one lotus, waterborne and hand adorn it, giving effort, calm austerities, patience, meditation, her sphere. Homage, crown of Tathagatas, actions triumph without limit, relied on by conqueror's children, having reached every perfection. Homage, filling with Tutare, whom desire direction and space, trampling with her feet the seven worlds, able to draw forth all beings. Homage, worshipped by the All-Lord, Chakra, Agni, Brahma, Maru, honored by the host of spirits, corpse-raisers, Gandharvas, Yakshas. Homage, with her tray and pay sounds, destroying foes' magic diagrams, her feet pressing left upright in, blazing in a raging fireblaze. Homage to Ray, very dreadful, destroyer of Mara's champions, she with frowning lotus visage, who is slayer of all enemies. Homage at the heart, her fingers adorn her with three jewel mudra, light ray masses all excited, all directions wheels adorn her. Homage, she so joyous, radiant, crown emitting garlands of light, mirthful laughing with Tutare, subjugating Mara's devas. Homage, she able to summon all earth guardians assembly, shaking, frowning with her whom sign, saving from every misfortune. Homage, crown adorned with crescent, moon all ornaments most shining, Amitabha in her hair knot, sending out much light eternal. Homage, she midwreath ablaze like eon ending fire abiding, right strut step and joy surrounds you, troops of enemies destroying. Homage, she who strikes the ground with her palm and with her foot beats it, scaling with a letter whom the seven levels she does conquer. Homage, happy, virtuous, peaceful, she whose field is peace, nirvana, she endowed with om and soha, destroyer of the great evil. Homage, she with joy surrounded, tearing foes' bodies asunder, frees with whom in knowledge mantra, arrangement of the 10 letters. Homage, Shure with seed letter, of the shape of syllable, whom by foot stamping shakes the three worlds, Meru, Mandara, and Vindhya. Homage, holding in her hand the hair-marked moon of Deva Lake form, with twice-spoken Tata and Pei, totally dispelling poison. Homage, she whom gods and their kings and the Kinnaras do honor, armored in all joyful splendor, she dispels bad dreams and conflicts. Homage, she whose two eyes bright with radiance of sun and full moon, with twice Hara and Tutare, she dispels severe contagion. Homage, full of liberating power by the set of three natures, destroys hosts of spirits, yakshas, and raise corpses supreme Ture. These praises with the Ru mantras and prostrations thus are 21. Donna, do you want me to continue?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Om, I prostrate to the noble transcendent liberator. Homage, Tara, swift, heroic, eyes like lightning instantaneous, sprung from opening stamens of the Lord of Three Worlds, Tirban Lotus. Homage, she whose face combines 100 autumn moons at fullest, blazing with light rays resplendent as a 1,000-star collection. Homage, golden blue one lotus, waterborne in hand adorned, giving effort, calm austerities, patience, meditation, her sphere. Homage, crown of Tathagatas, actions triumph without limit, relied on by conqueror's children, having reached every perfection. Homage, filling with Tutare, whom desire direction and space, trampling with her feet the seven worlds, able to draw forth all beings. Homage, worshipped by the All-Lord, Chakra, Agni, Brahma, Maru, honored by the host of spirits, corpse-raisers, Gandharvas, Yakshas. Homage with her tray and pay sounds, destroying foes magic diagrams, her feet pressing left out right in, blazing in a raging fireblaze. Homage to a very dreadful destroyer of Mara's champions, she with frowning lotus visage, who is slayer of all enemies. Homage at the heart, her fingers adorn her with regal mudra, lyre masses all excited, all directions wheels adorn her. Homage, she so joyous, radiant, crown emitting garlands of light, mirthful lapping with Tutare, subjugating Mara's devas. Homage, she able to summon all earth guardians assembly, shaking, frowning with her home sign, saving from every misfortune. Homage, crown adorned with crescent, moon all ornaments most shining, Amitabha in her hair knot, sending a much light eternal. Homage, she mid-wreath ablaze like the unending fire abiding, right stretched left bent choice surrounds you, troops of enemies destroying. Homage, she who strikes the ground with harp palm and with her foot beats it, scaling with the letter whom the seven levels she does conquer. Homage, happy, virtuous, peaceful, she whose field is peace nirvana, she endowed with om and soha, destroyer of the great evil. Homage, she with joy surrounded, tearing foes bodies asunder, frees with human knowledge mantra, arrangement of the ten letters. Homage to Ray with seed letter of the shape of syllable whom by foot stamping shakes the three worlds, Meru, Manda, Ra, and Vindhya. Homage holding in our hand the hair marked moon of Deva Lake form, with twice spoken Tata and Pe, totally dispelling poison. Homage, she whom gods and their kings and the kinner rest to honor, armored in all joyful splendor, she dispels bad dreams and conflicts. Homage, she whose two eyes bright with radiance of sun and full moon, with twice Hara and Tutare, she dispels severe contagion. Homage, full of liberating power by the set of three natures, destroys us as spirits, yakshas, and raise corpses supreme Ture. These praises with the Ru mantras and prostrations, us are 21. Om, I prostrate to the noble transcendent liberator. Homage, Shara, swift, heroic, eyes like lightning instantaneous, sprung from opening stamens of the... Sorry, wasn't sure if Venerable Ravina was back. We'll start with verse 1 again. Homage, Shara, swift, heroic, eyes like lightning instantaneous, sprung from opening stamens of the Lord of Three Worlds, Tear Bone Lotus. Homage, she whose face combines 100 autumn moons at fullest, blazing with light rays resplendent as a 1,000-star collection. Homage, golden blue one lotus, water-born and hand-adorned, giving ever calm austerities, patience, meditation, her sphere. Homage, crown of Tathagatas, actions triumph without limit, relied on by conqueror's children, having reached every perfection. Homage, filling with Tutare, whom desire direction and space, trampling with her feet the seven worlds, able to draw forth all beings. Homage, worshipped by the All-Lord, Chakra, Agni, Brahma, Maru, honored by the host of spirits, corpse raisers, Gandharvas, Yakshas. Homage, with her tray and pay sounds, destroying foes' magic diagrams, her feet pressing left out right in, blazing in a raging fireblaze. Homage to Ray, very dreadful, destroyer of Mara's champions, she with frowning lotus
Venus here. She was here. Okay, let's keep.
Om Tara Tu Tare Ture Soha. So we'll start with verse 8 since it's the top. Homage to Ray, very dreadful, destroyer of Mara's champions, she with frowning lotus visage, who is slayer of all enemies. Homage at the harder fingers, adorn her with three jewel mudra, library masses all excited, all directions wheels adorn her. Homage, she's so joyous, radiant, crown emitting garlands of light, mirthful lapping with tutare, subjugating Mara's devas. Homage, she able to summon all earth guardians assembly, shaking, frowning with her hum sign, saving from every misfortune. Homage, crown adorned with crescents, moon all ornaments most shining, Amitabha in her hair knot, sending out much light eternal. Homage, she mid-wreath ablaze like ye unending fire abiding, right stretch, left venture surrounds you, troops of enemies destroying. Donna, we can't hear you at all.
Venerable Rubina, you're muted.
Are you hearing me now?
We hear you now.
So I'm at my iPad. Is it any better?
Looks good so far.
Okay, I want to see you guys, though. I can't see a damn thing.
Oh, okay.
Here you go. So I can see some of you. How's this? Is it a better connection with my iPad? Is it a better connection with my iPad?
It appears to be a better connection. So far, so good.
Well, we start trying and we'll see what happens. I mean, I can't see any of you. Can you see me okay on my skinny iPad? Maybe I'll go sideways. You can see all of the Buddha as well. Hang on. I can try that one. You know, I know you can see my navel. That's no good. Oh, my dear. That's so ridiculous. Here we go. Let me just try and put my computer up a bit or something. Hang on a minute. Let me see what I can do. I want you to see the Buddha behind me, not just my stupid face. I can't hold it like this. I'll get an ache in my arm. There somehow. What can I do? Hang on a tick. I'll get something. I'm falling over. Oh, this works. What's happening here? This works. We persevere. It's no good either. No good. Put my cup on there. See if that works. It's no good either. Oh, dear me. Hang on.
Try that.
You still can't see Buddha. Sort of you can see something, can't you?
Yes. A little bit of Buddha.
It's better to be vertical. It's no good this way. Here, try that. This way. Better to be that way. What to do? Okay, let's try. Let's try, people. Are we okay? Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes.
All right.
Yes. We've had consistent sound and video since you came in on your iPad.
Okay, good. Well, I don't know what's wrong. It's my computer that's the problem then. It's not the connection. It's my computer. Because I'm using the same hotspot connection, my phone. So my computer's gone berserk. Okay, people, let's carry on from last week. What I've been trying to do, what I want to do, is we looked at the three scopes of the Lam Rim. And what I'm trying to show is, by the first scope, the essence of which is abiding by the laws of karma. And what I'm trying to show is the implicit teaching there, as we learn to practice abiding by the laws of karma, we start to realize that actually it starts to help us loosen the grip of ego grasping, because it begins to chip away at the root delusion ego grasping, which is what dependent arising does, because we're beginning to understand dependent arising, because karma is an example of the first level of dependent arising, which is cause and effect. Already by working with karma, you abide by the laws of karma. You watch your body and speech. You don't kill. You don't steal. You don't harm. It feels very strict and very disciplined. But gradually, as we learn more and more about karma, to really kind of buy into this philosophical view of the universe, that everything we think and do and say produces the person we become, it starts to loosen the grip of ego grasping. It starts to lessen the feeling of self-pity me, poor me, not fair. I didn't ask to get born. It's not my fault. You start to take responsibility. And already that's loosening attachment, loosening the delusions, and loosening the grip of ego grasping. That's the thing to get, you know. So then, as we discussed last week, the second level is when we go to the next level, the next scope of the lamb realm, where we start to look into our mind itself. Again, the explicit teaching is realizing how disturbing the delusions are. But the deeper one, the deeper teaching there, as we learn to know about the mind, as we study Buddhist psychology, we start to see the deeper functioning, the deeper way, the more subtle way that the delusions function. They don't only disturb our mind, but they actually are misconceptions. That's what we really start to learn when we think about dependent arising, and we start to attack the root delusion, because it's then they really talk about how it's a misconception. You don't always, when you're studying in the second scope and you're practicing abiding by the, you're practicing lessening attachment, you're not thinking so much about how it's a delusion. But that's exactly, and that's the way Lama Zopa teaches. It's totally lying to us. And this is the one I think I want to talk about today. This is something that is not in modern psychology. This is not the way we talk. To some degree, you could argue that, behavioral thought.
Cognitive.
Yeah, that's right. Cognitive therapy. That's exactly what Buddha is. This is really the way to exactly bullseye say what Buddha is. He's a cognitive therapist. He is saying that the delusions, their particular function, ego grasping, the root delusion, which gives rise to attachment, which gives rise to aversion, which gives rise to the other 83,997, because they keep talking about 84,000 delusions, they all have this key function, one of being disturbing, but two, the crucial one, is that they are misconceptions. So straight away, that's a real confusion to us. You know, if you're angry and you see a person shouting and the spit is coming out of their mouth and their eyes are wide in horror and the words are coming out of their mouth all irrational, and you say that the person's got they're angry and they've got a misconception, you will laugh, because what we're seeing is an intense emotion. And this is part of our problem. While we can't see the conceptual aspect of our delusions, is that we only notice them when the body is involved. This is one of our major problems in the West. We are so addicted to our bodies, you know. We're so addicted to the experience of our bodies. We only think we are the body. We think the mind is my brain and the rest is my body. There is nothing else but the body. So because we are so addicted to our body, as Lama Yeshe says, we make the body the boss. Then this is the crucial point. We don't notice what is happening in our mind, in our mental consciousness, until the body is affected. So this is where we have to understand the mind. So when we study Lo-Rig, you know, which I'm sure you've done there with Geshe La and other people, so where you learn, the crucial thing you learn in the Buddhist model of the mind is this massive distinction between sensory consciousness and mental consciousness. So let's look at that, because this is very, very telling, okay? So mental consciousness... So this is where we learn the epistemological model of the mind. You learn the epistemological model of the mind, which actually is utterly fascinating. Modern therapists, modern psychologists, neuroscientists will be absolutely delighted to learn this view of the mind, but they first got to posit that they're not discussing the brain, and that's the difficult part, you know. We're not discussing the brain here. We're discussing the personal, subjective, cognitive process itself. So it works in two ways. One, we have sensory consciousness, and two, we have mental consciousness. So what's the difference? This is massive in Buddhist psychology. And until we understand this, we're not going to really understand our own minds. We're certainly not going to be able to distinguish between the body and the mind, you know? So, okay, sensory consciousness, by definition, of course, consciousness necessarily is not physical. So sensory consciousness, we've got five of those. We know that. We've got eye consciousness, ear consciousness, et cetera, et cetera. So spell it out in Buddhist terms. What that's saying is this, that we've got the eyeball, which is all we posit in the West. But for the Buddha, we've got an eyeball, absolutely, and you need an eyeball to have a proper cognition of the eye consciousness. But consciousness, by definition, is not physical. So eye consciousness is that part of your mind that functions through the medium of the eyeball and all the nerves being, you know, behaving properly. that enables you to have a cognition. So then ear consciousness the same, tactile consciousness, the five sensory consciousnesses. So the fact is these levels of cognition, these sensory consciousnesses, which we think are the most dominant part of our lives, our senses run the world. But we misinterpret them to the Buddha in a grotesque way. We give them much more power than they've actually got. So let's just use a simple example. Where's my example? I don't know. I had something. Where's my mug gone? I had a mug. Here it is. Here's my mug. So I'll tell you that that's a really nicely designed thermos. I like my thermos. So obviously, you know perfectly well, if I say it's a well-designed thermos, you know that's not my tactile consciousness talking. Possibly. It's not my ear consciousness. It's my eye consciousness. So obviously, without any discussion, we would just assume that Robina's eyes are seeing a well-designed thermos. Well, no, it's not like that. The sensory consciousnesses, all the consciousnesses, but they all are like, you know, with respect to animals, they're like dumb animals. They're completely, profoundly limited in their capacity for cognition. This is a big shock to us because we conflate emotions with our body, you know. We feel it in our body, we say. Some people, we can't even see the conceptual stories because we're so addicted to the physical feeling. And the trouble is, the physical feeling is the tip of the iceberg. So what happens here is this. Eye consciousness does not have the capacity to cognize a nicely designed thermos. The fact is the senses are profoundly limited. So eye consciousness has precisely two objects that it can cognize, shape and color. And that's it. Each of the senses has its own very specific objects, you know? So shape and color. So what's happening is this. My eye consciousness is cognizing shape and color. And then the next millisecond, and I mean it, quicker than Google, my mental consciousness is accessed. So what's that? That's where the workshop is, where the way Lama Zopa puts it. That's all your thoughts and feelings and emotions and unconscious and subconscious and instinct and intuition, this entire spectrum of our inner being. This is where the workshop is. That is the mind that Buddha is describing that we need to become intimately, sophisticatedly familiar with in order to distinguish between the delusions, the virtues, and the third lot. There are three categories, and we're going to go into this because this is the work we have to do. This is where we become a Buddhist. Abiding by the laws of karma, controlling your body and speech, not killing, not stealing, not jumping on the wrong partner, that's a crucial first level of practice. Absolutely the first step, as Lama Zopa says, but that's just the beginning because you're learning to control the servants of what? Your mind. Which part of your mind? What causes you to kill and steal is not virtue, I promise. It's attachment and anger. So it's too much to get into the mind first, so we control the servants of the mind first. That's the first scope. Now we're having disciplined to some degree our body and speech. We can now get into the second scope. I like to call it high school, and now become our own therapist. And so this is what does it mean become our own therapist? You've got to know what Buddha's model of the mind is. You can't just, oh yeah, I'm looking at my mind. I'm observing my feelings. We don't know how to say that. That's absurd because the Buddha's view is so specific. You know, if we don't study it, you can't actually say you're being a Buddhist. If you don't know exactly what attachment is and you can't define it, if you don't know exactly what love is and you can't define it, if you don't exactly know what the function of icon consciousness or whatever, then you're not being a Buddhist because he's got his own very specific model. You know, we need to understand this. So first point here we're making is the distinction between sensory consciousness and mental consciousness. But we conflate them here. We say, oh, what a wonderfully designed thermos, and my eyes are seeing it. No, they're not. So already this is very powerful. If I'm in love with Fred, oh, where's my boy? He's a boy here. Anthony, you're my boy. Anthony, you're on my picture here. So Anthony, let's say I say I'm in love with Anthony. Anthony is so handsome, I'll say. We all know it's our eye consciousness that's seeing him. You know, okay, if you're blind, it's a different discussion. So the eyes seem so powerful, and he appears so divine, and we really believe our eyes are seeing a divine person. Well, it's completely utter nonsense. What is actually happening is, as I said, eye consciousness sees that shape and color, and then instantaneously, and I'm not joking, quicker than Google, you know, 700 million in 1 second, the mental consciousness is quicker than that. Lama Yeshe says this in Mahamudra, that our mental consciousness is more brilliant than any computer. and this is the way it works conceptually, this is very fascinating, that my mental consciousness, what is there? It stored all my memories, all my thoughts, all my feelings, all my opinions, all my viewpoints. Because basically, now we look at mental consciousness, we've got two ways in which the mental consciousness functions. You learn this in Lowrig. So we've got the grosser level, which is conceptuality. And then you have a subtler level, which you only access once you've got shamatha. You only access the subtle level of cognition in the mental consciousness, which is what they call perception, direct perception, which is necessarily non-conceptual. Now, we have no kind of equivalent in modern psychology or neuroscience of that. It's only once you've got shamatha or got calm abiding, where you've completely subdued both the sensory and the conceptuality, and you've accessed these subtler levels of your mental consciousness. That's eventually where we have to go to get realizations. But we don't go anywhere near that. We don't have concentration. So we live at what level of the mental consciousness? Conceptual. Now, this is a big shock to us. Like I said before, you see a person shouting and yelling, and you say that they're living at a conceptual level. You would laugh at that. What are you talking about? That's emotion, we'll say. So we divide our mind into intellect, which is 1 + 1 = 3, all the clever physics and clever music, you know, musical theory, cooking theory, all the intellectual. You know, that's intellectual as far as we're concerned. And then we have feelings. Then we have emotions. Well, the irony is, for the Buddha, emotions are a grosser level. They're gross. It's the body. And that's our problem, because we so adore our experience, our emotions. We think they're more subtle. No way. It's only when that's when the body is involved, and the body is the tip of the iceberg of our mental capacity. The body is the sensory. And because you see, and the more and more we understand, well, we won't go there now, don't worry. So mental consciousness, which at the level we function, is merely conceptuality. That means the thousands of feelings and thoughts and emotions and unconscious and subconscious, instinct, intuition, all of this, we're living at a conceptual level. Now, the trouble is, and Western psychology says this, we have like 1,000 thoughts a second. So it seems like a joke that we're able to unpack and unravel all these thoughts. But we've first got to realize how they're all thoughts. Anger is a thought. Attachment is a thought. Jealousy is a thought. They're thoughts. But this is like a joke for us. So what does it mean, they're thoughts? So this is where we have to understand the Buddhist model of the mental consciousness now. Well, as we all know, if we study it, and this is how I talk about all the time, our mental consciousness at the level of conceptuality, which is day-to-day life, we have precisely three categories of states of mind. There is no fourth. There are those that are negative, neurotic, delusional, distressing, that lead us up a garden. You can't have up a garden without a pedal. It's up a creek without a pedal, isn't it? They're completely, totally disturbing. They make you utterly miserable. And the crucial point is what I'm getting to. They are liars because they're misconceptions. So attachment, anger, the three poisons, ego grasping, which is the one we're getting to, because that's the one that by thinking about dependent arising, that's the one we have to get to. That cuts the root of the root delusion, which is this deep conceptual story that totally posits and believes in a real, inherent, intrinsic me. That deep delusion, we can call it colloquially ego grasping, then gives rise to effectively the main cause of all our suffering in day-to-day life, the conception called attachment. And then when that attachment doesn't get what it wants, that gives rise to the conception called aversion or anger. And then all the other 83,997 are rooted in those three. That's why Buddha calls them the three root delusions, you know. As Ling Rinpoche, the young Ling Rinpoche, I don't know if he's come to Kadampa Center, as he says, you know, 21,000 of those 84,000 delusions are rooted in ego grasping. 21,000 are rooted in attachment. 21,000 are rooted in aversion. That's the three poisons. All those 84,000 subsumed to those three. And the fourth 21,000 are rooted in all three. So it's a really sophisticated view, a map of the mind, of all the deluded states of mind, the disturbing states of mind. And this is the entire point from here to Buddhahood that Buddha is making, that unless we understand this, we don't understand what Buddha is saying, and we will never understand why it is we can remove these delusions from our mind. Because if we think of them as emotions and we think of them as physical, then forget removing them. It's not a possibility. You know, we tried cutting out bits of the brain back in the 1930s. We called it a lobotomy, and it didn't work. We're not discussing the physical. So what we have to understand is these deeply powerful, disturbing emotions that are totally automatic, totally programmed in our mind from countless lifetimes of believing in them, that fundamentally they are conceptual stories and they are misconceptions. And a misconception is what? If I say to you 1 + 1 = 3, you know perfectly well I'm not speaking the truth, because we've all learned math and we know that's a misconception. Well, me believing that Anthony is the cause of my happiness is a misconception. Attachment will tell me that Anthony is totally divine. That's a misconception. These are literally misconceptions. They're literally conceptual stories. So that's the mental consciousness. We're living in this chaos of thousands of different thoughts, many of which are the emotional afflictions, the emotional delusions, and they're the ones that are called attachment and anger and jealousy and all the rest. And we know the emotional component. We feel it every day. So why do we feel it in our body? This is very interesting. I mean, if we understand the Vajrayana model of the universe, which is what we learn about, I mean, when we learn the death process, for example, we learn very clearly about how, you know, as Holina says, in the teachings, we've got gross consciousness, which is our sensory, which is inextricably linked to our gross body, this bag of bones. So, gross consciousness, which is the sensory consciousness, eye, ear, etc., you can't have those without a body. You can't have eye consciousness. It doesn't work if you don't have an eyeball. So they are inextricably linked. Then you've got subtle consciousness. Now, that's your mental consciousness. Even though we access them at this grosser level, that's all your thoughts and feelings and emotions, your virtuous and positive states of mind, like love and compassion. They are also conceptual stories. They are also rooted, those emotions are rooted in the conceptual story that's called love, that's called kindness, that's called generosity, that's called compassion. They are conceptual stories. So the thing is, the subtle consciousness is the mental consciousness, and then we've got subtle body. Now, that's the 72,000 subtle channels coursing through our body. And then all the wind energies, or prana, as they call it in Sanskrit, all the different wind energies, and this is the Tibetan medical system, all the thousands of wind energies coursing through those 72,000 channels that our different states of mind are inextricably linked to. That's the key thing in this Vajrayana model. So if you can just even imagine that, hypothesize that, you've got all these different wind energies, all the different levels of them, coursing through these 72,000 channels from the tip of your head to your toenails, and then along in those channels, inextricably linked to those wind energies, which are physical, are your states of mind, and you can't separate these. So, you know, your Tibetan doctor, when she feels your pulses, she will feel an imbalance of certain winds that she knows are completely connected to your attachment. And that's why you're going berserk having panic attacks, because your attachment's gone berserk. So she gives you, herbal medicine that calms down the wind energies. And that, because it's linked to your attachment now is able to calm down. They have a saying, they say the mind rides on the winds, you know. And this is not the model that Dr. Robert Watkins would give you if you visited him. He gives you your Prozac. It'll be something different. But the principle is the same. The body and the mind are connected. So this, and then that, because if your attachment's very strong, so people know what attachment is this primordial emotional hunger from countless lives of practicing and believing in the concept that that body and that cake are more delicious than they really are, and when I get them, I'll get happy. That's the concept that attachment is saying. But because it's so primordially programmed in us, we don't hear the concept. We just feel the consequences of practicing it, which is this deep panic and emotion. And then aversion, what's anger? If you see that person shouting and yelling, spit coming out their mouth and their eyes wide, we think that anger, we think the emotion is anger. That's just the body. So obviously the anger in the mind, which is very strong anger, and anger is a response when attachment doesn't get what it wants, this powerful concept that how dare you do that to me, I don't deserve it, that's the thought of anger that believes that that action is the cause of all my suffering. And then it's linked to those wind energies. The stronger your anger, the more intense the physical experience. You see the person screaming and shouting and yelling. So this is just the external manifestation of the presence in your mind of attachment, aversion, and all the others. So, you know, when you're full of despair, you feel it physically, but it's not a physical, the physical is real. That's because the mind connected to those winds is doing its thing in your body, you know, but attachment is not the body. Anger is not the body, but it's connected to the body, so it impacts upon the body, which gives us physical feelings. So, I mean, when the way we think about attachment, and I'm not trying to be too gross here, but, you know, when you're in love with your boyfriend, you have these incredible physical experiences when you have contact with that delicious object. It seems like a joke to say even that the pleasure is not physical or that the attachment is not physical, because it feels a totally physical experience. So the body is involved. We have to learn the difference. We have to see the function of the body, how the body relates to the mind. What is the mind? What is a delusion? What is a virtue? This is the nuts and bolts of Buddhist psychology, especially if you learn the Vajrayana model. It's so helpful. Without this, you will not understand. Jung's model doesn't talk like this, nor does Freud's, nor does anybody else's. So we are talking here, the real point I'm getting at is here, when we start to deal with the emotions, the delusions, the disturbing emotions, the disturbing afflictions, as they call them, as we start to practice, we realize the pain of them, but then we're going to start to become familiar with how they are conceptual stories. So, I mean, attachment is defined. When you study Lohrig, there's a very simple definition. Attachment is a conceptual story, conceptual viewpoint that exaggerates the deliciousness of the object, whether it's the chocolate cake or Anthony's body. It's the same. So what is aversion? Aversion is the bare bones state of mind that anger is a volatile expression of, that is also a conceptual state of mind that exaggerates the ugly qualities of the object. That's the definition of anger. That's the definition of attachment. So that tells you there are misconceptions. So what does it mean they are misconceptions? This is the point. It tells us that the degree to which attachment is running your mind is the degree to which the object, in this case Anthony and his body, is the degree to which Anthony will appear back to me, as Wei Lama Zo puts it, the object called Anthony and his body, which is body mostly, will appear back to me in the aspect of that attachment. So in other words, you've got your rose-colored spectacles on. So we all know that when you've got your rose-colored spectacles on, the object will look divine. The cake will look divine. And our tragedy is, bad enough, as Lama Zopa says, that the object appears wrongly to you. But the killer is, we believe the story is true. That's what keeps us paralyzed in samsara. So this is where we at least understand the theory of how these conceptual stories, attachment, anger, jealousy, and the other 83,000, whatever, are disturbing. And why are they disturbing? It's because they're liars. They're liars. That's why they're disturbing. This sounds so peculiar to us. But it sort of makes sense. You know, Buddha says we've had these disturbing delusions, disturbing emotions for a long time. So we've built up all these habits, you know. So, for example, if you've got a $5 note, and you are convinced and have been since you've had $5 notes that actually it says 50. You even see 50. You believe it's 50. Therefore, look at this. It's so clear. You have all, then your expectations of what you get when you go to spend it will be $50 worth. And every time you go to spend your $5, completely convinced it's 50, what do you think is going to happen when you only get $5 worth? You'll be devastated. You'll be disappointed. You will freak out. You will be disturbed. And that's how we are with these delusions. They're so intensely programmed in our mind that even though we hear that attachment's a liar, even though we hear the cake is not what it appears to be, it appears to us so strongly, and that's from eons of habit, and we still keep believing it. I mean, you'd say that's the attitude of a really stupid person. We're bashing our heads against brick walls for eons. And that's how deep the delusions are. In other words, you've been trying so hard to get $50 worth from your five, and you've been doing it for countless lives, and you never learn the lesson. You do it again tomorrow, and you'll do it again the next day. That's how deeply deluded we are. And this is the delusional aspect. And the more we've done this habit of attachment, the more we believe in that lie, the more disturbed we are. This is the relationship between disturbing emotion and delusion. They're the two functions of the neurotic states of mind. And this is in high school. This is when we understand this with attachment and anger. This is leading us to get to the root delusion, which is how they talk about. They don't really talk like this until you get to ego grasping, and we start to really see how it's a misconception, how ego grasping, how ignorance, maripa, the root delusion. And what is its belief? What is this root delusion telling us? What is the definition of the root delusion? Is it's a delusion like attachment, like anger, like jealousy. It's a conceptual story like attachment, like anger, like jealousy. But it's the root misconception, much more subtle, much more primordial. So in other words, when the eye consciousness sees that shape and color, and instantaneously, you know, the brown triangle on the plate, and instantaneously the mental consciousness is accessed, and up comes this story because of eons of habit. That's a chocolate cake. Now, that's a valid concept. Chocolate cake is a valid concept conventionally. It is a chocolate cake. It's not a carrot cake. You get that part right. But the part that's the liar is coming from here, this emotional hunger, this feeling I'm not enough, I don't have enough, because that's what attachment is. That's the emotional component of attachment, that I am not enough, I don't have enough. This terrible feeling of being bereft and not having enough and not being enough. That's the energy of attachment from the habit of believing in this concept. And then the eye consciousness sees the cake, and then it calls it chocolate cake. Then all the attachment kicks in, the belief that it's going to make me happy when I get it, and all the expectations come, like spending your $5, and you're expecting joy and happiness. You're expecting incredible satisfaction to come. This is just a cake. Forget Anthony's body. And what happens? You eat the first mouthful. And this definitely does trigger pleasure. Pleasure is, and this is another whole discussion. We've got to work out what pleasure is. That's in the third category of states of mind. It's not a virtue, not a non-virtue. We've got to discuss this one. It triggers a pleasant feeling. No argument. Buddha does not argue, but what happens, this is a tragedy. Because the addiction of attachment is that we're never satisfied. You've got to hear this. Attachment is the energy of never being satisfied. So you get the mouthful, the delicious cake. It's the best cake on the planet. It's the best cake. Your stomach's empty. All the conditions are there perfect. You get the first mouthful. The pleasure is really delicious. But even as you're chewing the cake, you're still not satisfied. So in attachment is already anticipating the second cake. This is exactly how attachment functions. It's a bottomless pit of just panic-stricken, never satisfied. Like when I remember reading one fellow, whatever it is, you know, if you're attached, a girl, he's attached to girls. So he's jumping on his 20th girl that day, and already he's thinking of a 21st girl. And one girl who was on Tinder, I heard about Tinder. It wasn't when I was young, I didn't have Tinder. Would have been so much easier to get boys. I had to go walk around the streets and find them. Tinder, you just press a button. I think it's delicious. I'm so excited for you, all you young people. Anyway, Tinder, this girl told me, I've been reading about this girl. She was so disappointing. There she is getting dressed after having sex with this nice boy that she found on Tinder. And there he is on Tinder finding the next girl. That's dissatisfaction. No matter what you get, as my mother used to say, the more you get, the more you want. I think and think and think about this. It's the energy of attachment. But we believe when I get the cake, I'll get happy. But even in the process of one mouthful, two mouthfuls, and look what happens. By the third mouthful, already you're feeling so distressed, although you can't stand to look at it, because already the pleasure is diminishing. The attachment is still hungry like a vampire, and you keep hoping the next mouthful will do it. Until what happens? By the fourth piece, you have to leave it there, otherwise you would vomit. We know this, and this is how we've been getting pleasure for eons, and we never learn the lesson. We try again tomorrow. And the tomorrow we forget that it's only $5. We forget we won't get $50 worth, but we're all excited all over again. And with the cake, we completely forget that the very object that caused me to vomit is the object that I think, well, maybe you just make, give me pleasure this time. I'll try it again. That's how demented we are. And we shouldn't be critical. We should be heartbroken at our insanity. This is mental illness. I'm not joking. This is mental, serious mental illness. And it's called attachment. And it's a liar. It's a misconception. And its root, is the, so okay, with how this, the delusions function together, you've got the root delusion, ignorance, ma ridpa, that has the, so then you see the cake, attachment is the overt one, the obvious, the logic, the most, the kind of the evident one. Attachment is seeing, is over-exaggerating the deliciousness of the cake. But ignorance, which underpins the attachment, you can't have attachment without the root delusion underpinning it. They're both together, working together. So attachment exaggerates the deliciousness of the chocolate cake. Ignorance exaggerates the very ontological status itself of the cake, the cakeness. This is even more subtle. It's even more subtle. So we only get to that one when we get to understand dependent arising, you know. But we prepare our minds by first controlling our body and speech and understanding and becoming more or less neurotic and less deluded. And then we get to high school here now in middle scope and we start to see how attachment is disturbing, but it's delusional. It's a liar. It leads us into insanity. It's a liar and we believe it. That's why Lama Zopi says, at least, you see the cake looking more delicious, but if you, at least you stop believing in it. This is putting atomic bombs under the delusions. You know it's not $50. It appears to you to be $50, but you keep telling yourself, Rabin, there's only $5. You don't believe it because it still appears like $50. The cake still appears to be the thing that will make you happy. Anthony still appears to be the divine object that when I get him, I'll make happy. You don't believe it. That's the most powerful practice because you can't expect to have the appearances change yet because that's old, ancient karmic habit from eons and eons and eons. They even say the greatest yogis in their meditation have seen there is no intrinsic I, but they open their eyes, they still see everything as intrinsic, but they don't believe it. This is the most powerful practice. And these words are mysterious if we don't unpack them and understand what Buddha means by being a misconception. Literally, a concept that is not. And it's misconception because it doesn't have a basis in reality. Attachment has no basis in reality. The cake isn't that. The cake you see on the plate through the lenses of your attachment and the cake that exists on the plate are not the same object. This is the point the Buddha's making. This is helping us understand. And then when we get to the six perfections and we get to the sixth one, where we start to really start to unpack ego grasping, the root delusion, now we're really ready for it. You know, we can understand. We're prepared. We prepared our mind by practicing the previous practices in the Lam Rim. First abiding by the laws of karma and then by understanding the way the mind works, you know. This is the Buddha's approach. Any questions, people? Have I made any sense at all? It's my computer that's wrong completely. My poor old computer. I wonder what's wrong with it. I hope I didn't lose any documents because it went a bit peculiar before. Never mind, my iPad's working. So come on, any questions, you folks? I need to hear any questions, please. Anything at all about whatever I've said. Hopefully some of it made sense. I can only see six of you. That's the problem. What can I say? What can I do? Never mind. Any questions, darlings? Can you see the relationship I'm making between seeing how attachment is a delusion and attachment is one of the three poisons and how the root delusion is called ignorance, which is the one that clings to the self-existent me, and how they both function as being misconceptions? One is more subtle than the other. You have to ask me some questions. Come on. I'm happy to talk, as you can see, but I want questions. Any questions? I don't care.
There's a question in chat that was posted right when you came in, so it's not responsive to the teaching. The question is, Buddhism is non-theistic. Buddha did not give revelations. We know that. How to reconcile this with a concept of many deities, Taras, Avalokiteshvara?
Oh, yeah. Okay, we can discuss that. That's got nothing to do with the creator. It's just a word that's used called deity in Tantra. And all, I mean, okay, that, to understand that, we have to understand the word Buddha. So let's discuss that briefly now. The word Buddha actually refers to a consciousness, a mind that has done the job that Buddha did, that has caused that person's mind to be completely free of all the delusions and to completely have developed to perfection all the virtues and all the wisdom. That's what Buddha says is possible. So everybody can become a Buddha. Now, that's one of the terms they even use in Buddhism is superior being. Even I remember I gave a talk at the Catholic Monastery, Catholic University in Melbourne, my city in Australia, years ago. I was brought up a Catholic, and I had this 20-minute little topic. I had a 20-minute little slot in this conference, and I didn't know. I remember I didn't know what to talk about until I got to the conference, and I looked up my dictionary. I didn't know what to talk about. I looked up the dictionary, the definition of God, and it said three essential qualities: infinite wisdom, infinite compassion, and infinite power. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because they're the same three qualities of a person called a Buddha. So it seems to me over the centuries, many, you know, all the Christians and the Muslims and the Buddhists, many people who have gone into religious philosophy have come up with similar findings. So you could argue a similarity here. And my talk was the similarity between the definition of God and Buddha. I don't know if the Catholics liked it, my talk, but that's what it was. But so the Buddha's point, the Christian's point is this, that there is one energy called God, only one of them, and that energy that has those three qualities is the creator of the universe, is the boss. The Buddha's view is no. There's no boss of the universe. You don't need a creator, because the Buddha's view of karma tells us that we each create ourselves. So the Buddha's saying that every one of us has the potential to develop infinite wisdom, infinite compassion, infinite power, and Buddha labels that Buddha. Buddha, free of all the rubbish, full of all the goodness. And everybody can become that. So in Tantra, all these different Buddhas, they're just different manifestations of different psychological qualities, and they're practices that we cultivate. So if you want to cultivate compassion, you imagine this Buddha mind, this perfected mind manifesting in the aspect of compassion. If you want to develop wisdom, you visualize this enlightened mind manifesting as wisdom. They're just different. It's just basically psychology, but it's like a visual psychology. It doesn't look like psychology to us, but they're all just different manifestations of Buddha mind. And they're not creators. There's no view like that in Buddhism. So I hope that answers that question for that person. What other questions are there? Are there any other questions?
Yes, there's another one from a viewer in YouTube. The question is, if attachment makes you feel better, then what's wrong with that?
Who said it makes you feel better? Are you telling me it does, or you're asking me? I need to have a conversation. I can't do this. This is no good. So the person, I can't speak to them, right? They're on YouTube.
Right, they're on YouTube.
Okay, this person, I don't know, darling, what your definition of attachment is. But attachment, attachment is this emotional... This is emotional hunger that's based on the assumption that I'm not enough, which is a lie, that then causes us to believe the chocolate cake will make me happy, the boyfriend will make me happy. So initially you get the chocolate cake, it does trigger a pleasant feeling. So attachment technically isn't the cause of the pleasant feeling. It simply is like a catalyst. It triggers a pleasant feeling. So nothing wrong with pleasant feelings. The Buddha says the more, Lama Yeshe would joke and say the more pleasure, the better. Nothing wrong with pleasant feelings, but we confuse attachment with the pleasant feelings, and we confuse the attachment with the cake. But in the end, the experience is pretty evident that when you believe the cake will give you pleasure, it does trigger pleasure, but the pleasure doesn't last. It turns in, you keep eating the cake. And why do you keep eating it? Because you're not satisfied. So no matter how many pieces you have, you won't be satisfied. And eventually the pleasure turns into vomit. So it turns into suffering. So there is some pleasure there. Nothing wrong with pleasure. The more pleasure, the better. But the Buddha's telling us the system we use to get the pleasure, which is attachment, is actually a lie. It doesn't work. And the Buddha's view is that when we've given up attachment, what you've got now is permanent pleasure. You've got pleasure that you can't even imagine. The mind is blissfully joyful all the time. So Buddha's saying the method we use now is really inferior method. He's not being moralistic. Nothing wrong with pleasure. The more pleasure, the better, honey. But it's got nothing to do with attachment. It's a mistake. It's like the happiness of a junkie. The happiness of a sex junkie who needs 20 girls a day, and in the end, you're not even satisfied. You're even more miserable. We all know that. The more you get, the more you want, my mother would tell me. So we've got to look into that. pleasure, the more the better, honey. But pleasure is not attachment. They're separate states of mind. We conflate them. Lorna had a question. I saw Lorna's hand up. Was it, the question has gone away, has it, Lorna?
No, I just can't clarify it in my own mind, so I'll
wait. Give it a go. Speak it out, darling, and see how it comes and see what happens. It might help.
Well, it was just when you were talking about feelings, emotions, and the level of cognition. So I understand that the emotions, we have emotions that are part of the makeup of our mind, right?
I don't know what that means, part of the makeup of our mind. What do you mean by that?
Well, the contents of our mind, when we describe the map of the mind, emotions yes. are part of it, right?
Emotion is a word that we use in the West for a state of mind that's got packed with lots of physical feelings. So there's no technical term for emotion in the Buddhist model. We've got states of mind. Some are have an emotional component. And when we say that, we mean the ones where the body's involved and your heart is beating fast and it's very delicious or very painful. But it's still rooted. That the physical is just the manifestation of the strength of that state of mind in your mind, which is not physical.
Okay, that's clearer for me.
You're with me. In other words, if anger is a very strong habit, then the more the habit is to be angry, the more automatic you'll have that concept. But it's so habitual that you'll only just end up experiencing the physical feeling because your body is attacked by that state of mind. Because the mind and the wind energies, remember in the subtle, the Vajrayana, the subtle wind energies and the mind are intimately connected. So the more strong the habit to have an angry thought is in the mind, the more it impacts upon the physical wind energies, which is what causes the body to feel so much feeling. A person who has very mild anger, they wouldn't even hardly notice it. The body wouldn't be really affected. It would be very mild. They get irritated. They might get annoyed slightly because their habit of anger isn't so strong. But the stronger the concept of anger, how dare you do that to me, which means the stronger the attachment, the stronger the physical emotion. But that's just the physical is an expression of the presence in the mind of the habit of that series of thoughts, that cognitive concept. Do you understand?
Yes, yeah.
Good.
Which is
good.
That which with ego, it's all part of it. That's what ego is.
They're all the voices of ego. Exactly, darling. Exactly.
Okay, but
that's
compassion and love and generosity are voices of
The virtue, they're virtue, and they're not by definition ego-based. And they can also have emotion, you see, Lorna. Well, if you've got a lot of compassion, you will cry when you see someone suffer. But that's not called suffering. That's just called emotion because your compassion is so strong. I mean, Dalai Lama, he might burst into tears when he talks about compassion. So that means his emotion is very strong, but it's rooted in being a virtuous state of mind. It's okay. Not a disturbing emotion. Do you understand my point?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Good point, Lorna. Anybody else, people?
There's another question in chat.
Good.
And then after this, another one from YouTube.
Good.
This one is, would you please explain more about how the object casts an aspect? Is it the mix of the object and whatever mental factors are present in the mind?
That's a really good point, yes. Yes, very much. It's you know, the real thing is it's the mind. It's the way, okay, basically these conceptual stories in the mind, in the mental consciousness, they are conceptual, they're opinions. So basically, you know, like the eye consciousness sees shape and color, and then the next millisecond, the mental consciousness is accessed, and then that's full of these thousands of conceptual stories, which are simply opinions. So when I say that is a well-designed thermos, or I say Anthony is divine-looking, that literally is a conceptual story. It's an opinion in my mental consciousness. Now, if Anthony's my ex-boyfriend and he's cheated on me, believe me, my same eyes will seem the same shape. We all know this, which just proves that it's the mind that makes up the object. I will see somebody disgusting. I won't even bear to see his name. I'll get so upset. I can't even stand to look at the man. And the fact of the matter is, if I show you a photo of Anthony when I was in love with him, and Anthony 1 month later when I hate him, you won't see the difference. So this is proving it's the mind. And these are the delusions that make up the fantasy, you know. So this, and even when we finally get to emptiness, and we're going to get to now, let's just bring it. Ego, the root delusion called Ma Rigpa. the root most subtle, most primordial conceptual mistake is that there is an intrinsic, real, definite, ugly Anthony out there in front of me. There's, or if I'm in love with him, there's a real, divine, handsome, intrinsic Anthony out there coming from his own side, having zero to do with my mind. That's how everything appears to us. So we don't think the mind plays any role at all. Buddha's saying literally the opposite. Literally the opposite. That the mind, there is a basis there. There is a basis. There is the aggregates, there's body, there's a person with a beard and hair, and we label him Anthony. That part's correct. But the Anthony that appears to me through either my attachment or aversion, depending on the day, is not the Anthony that exists out there. And as Lama Zopa says, when we're finally getting more and more into the root delusion, which is what we're doing, what he says, when you realize, so this is okay, now let's talk about emptiness. We're leading to it. Well, the best way to see it is in the framework of dependent arising. This is the two truths. Tsongkhapa wrote his beautiful lyrical song of praise to the Buddha for his beautiful teachings on dependent arising. And as Lama Yeshe says, paraphrasing the Buddha, the dependent arising is the king of logics the king of logics to prove emptiness. So you've got the two truths. You've got dependent arising, conventional reality. The way everything in the universe exists, it exists as a conventional truth, as a dependent arising, as something that's interdependent, as something that exists in dependence upon various factors, and we'll go into this. That's the way of presenting the conventional, the first of these so-called truths. And that is then the other one is that the shorthand for conventional reality is dependent arising. The shorthand for ultimate or final reality is emptiness. So, of course, these appear totally different to us right now. And we're going to unpack all this now and later on in the next teachings. So, you know, as Lama Zopa says, when we've begun to realize the emptiness of Anthony, it's as if there is no Anthony out there. But dependent arising, there is an Anthony. But what does exist is so subtle, it's as if he's an illusion. So this is a yogi's experience. So it seems kind of mind-boggling to talk like this, you know? Because right now we've got the two wrong views. We've got the two extreme views. So when we hear there is no Anthony from his own side, we chuck the baby out with the bathwater and go, oh, well, there's no Anthony. Oh, well, there's no negative Anthony. He didn't really harm me after all. It's all just an illusion. And we fall into the abyss of the great mistake, as Buddha puts it. Tsongkhapa puts it. That's too extreme. That's nihilism. Then you've got the other truth, which is that there is an Anthony that did harm me. Anthony did cheat on me. And we go, well, then now what we do now, we over-exaggerate the Anthony-ness, and we say there is a negative Anthony. There's a real intrinsic bad Anthony who really did harm me. So the Buddha's telling us, and we sort of think, well, Buddha, make up your mind, mate. Is there an Anthony or is there not an Anthony? You know, we can't work it out. We go crazy. So we've got to put these two truths together. And what I'm getting at is, by first abiding by the laws of karma, you start to loosen the grip of this ego grasping because it starts to make you more spacious and more confident and less neurotic and less self-pity. And then you get to high school and you start to look at the mind, and now you get to understand how these delusions function, how they're bones. This prepares us to now get into the actual nuts and bolts of understanding dependent arising as a king of logics to prove how nothing has an intrinsic nature. It prepares our mind. So you could argue that everything comes from the mind. That does not mean that there isn't an Anthony who cheated on me. But the Anthony who cheated on me is sort of, this is the way to put it, the Anthony who cheated on me does exist as a dependent arising. But when we've understood emptiness, it's as if there's no Anthony, but it doesn't deny. So in other words, emptiness does not annihilate existence. Emptiness does not argue with existence, but we hear it like that now, you know. That's the mistake we make. So we've got to start putting these two truths together. And when we're on the right track, whenever we hear dependent arising, that will tell us, ha-ha, that means emptiness. And every time we hear
emptiness that will tell us, ha ha, that means dependent arising. Whereas now they appear as opposite. There's either nothing or the something, and we can't see the difference. So our minds have got to become more subtle, more nuanced, you know, in our understanding. And this is why you just don't leap into emptiness. You've got to go to junior school first, then high school. You prepare your mind by abiding by the laws of karma. You prepare your mind by understanding the emotions and the delusions and how they function. This gets us ready to hear in a more realistic way these two truths and how they function. So you could argue everything comes from the mind, but that doesn't mean there's no Anthony. That's the thing, that's the point. This is why all the examples Rinpoche gives, you know. I mean, the one example I love to use is prison. You know, I've got lots of friends in prison. So as soon as you hear the word prison, if you looked up, you know, in the old-fashioned days, you look up the real estate pages and you see, oh, free rent in a prison. You wouldn't want to go there, I promise, even if it's the nicest prison. Unless, of course, it's in Norway or somewhere. I mean, I've got a friend a couple of years ago who emailed me. He was in Norway, and he was so excited. He had a 2-year sentence in prison. He couldn't wait to get there because it was in the country. It was beautifully designed. It was a college. He was going to learn gardening. He was going to learn school. He couldn't wait to go to prison. Prisons aren't like that in this country, I promise. So anyway, this just proves the point about prison. There's no inherent prison. So the bottom line is, okay, so prison. So this is the point. If we believe right now with ego that when Anthony cheats on me, that is the main cause of my suffering. And that's it. There's one cause, and it's called Anthony. If you go to prison, as far as we're concerned, you're unhappy because you're in an ugly prison. Even if the prison's pretty, you still feel it's horrible because no one chooses to go to prison. So we believe I'm unhappy because the prison is ugly. We believe I'm unhappy because because the weather is bad. We believe I'm unhappy because Anthony was mean to me. And Buddha's saying, no, it's more nuanced than that. He's not arguing that Anthony didn't cheat on you. He could see he cheated on you. He's not saying the prison isn't a shitty place to be. He's not saying the weather isn't terrible. That's the thing. He's just saying the mind plays much more powerful role than we would ever imagine, you know. I mean, I always quote this. Lama Zopa said, this seems too shocking for us initially, but this is the point, that the vast majority of all humans on the planet, what time is it? 6:30. 8:30 for you. What time did we start?
Oh, we started about 7:45, I believe.
So what time are we supposed to finish? How long have we got?
9:00.
Oh, we've got time. Okay, good. Fantastic. Yeah. Okay, so then, you know, Lama Zopa said, this is very shocking initially, that the vast majority of all humans on the planet, he's talking about the most intelligent ones as well, have absolutely no idea that what goes on in their mind plays any role at all in their lives. This seems impossible, doesn't it? But analyze it. This is how we think. In other words, you can sit there being angry, resentful, bitter, and then you think that as long as no one notices your thoughts, it doesn't matter. I can think what I like, we say, as if it doesn't play a role. We think it's all the outside. We think it's all Anthony. I'm this innocent victim. I did nothing to deserve it. And this evil Anthony cheated on me. That's how ego talks. That's how ego feels. I've got nothing to do with it. And that's exactly the point. We believe it's completely separate from me. We believe it's got nothing to do with me. We don't have any understanding of interdependence, that I am a major player in this relationship. So one is karma. I mean, this is too shocking for our minds, but if Anthony is kind to me, that's because I've been kind to him. So already I'm the main cause of his being kind. And second, I'm happy now because I've got virtue. So I'm the main player in this. Anthony's just this catalyst that triggers a happy feeling in my mind. I caused the happy feeling by being past virtuous, and I caused him to be kind to me by being kind to him. I'm the main player. This is what you get from karma. Forget, you know, the mind. It's so powerful, and it's the opposite of what we think in our culture. It is the opposite. Our mind is the main player. Our mind makes up the chocolate cake. There is a chocolate cake there. It's not being nihilistic. It's not saying everything's the mind. That's nihilism. That's nonsense. It's ridiculous. There is a chocolate cake. There is an Anthony. He was kind. He did cheat. Well, they're the truths. But the main player in the experience that we have of that is our mind. from past karma and our present states of mind. And finally, that really comes into play when we understand dependent arising and we finally cut the root of the main delusion that believes there's an intrinsic me and intrinsic everything else, you know. This is super delicious stuff. There's just this gradual process of preparing our minds and studying it carefully, knowing the right words, knowing the right theories. You can't just leap into these experiences without understanding the words, you know. It's not possible. Any more questions there, Donna?
Yes, there's one in from YouTube. Yeah. The question is, I remember hearing from a Buddhist teacher, I don't remember who, but it may have been Pema Chodron, that the awakened mind is fearless. Can you give us some more detail on this?
Absolutely, yes. Lama Yeshe says it this. Lama, as Lama Zopa says, and Lama Yeshe, any of the Lamas say. And this seems, this is literal. Hear this word, hear this literally, please. That when we have cut all the delusions, when we have cut the root delusion, the one that clings to the self-existent me, when we have cut the attachment, which is the main voice of that root delusion, when we have cut the anger, which is the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants, there's a hierarchy of all these delusions. They're all intimately related to each other, you know? So when we've cut all of that, you have no fear. Try and hear this. This is the thing that we don't think, but analyze this. Check this. You'll agree. Check when you're attached. The panic, the anxiety. If that's not fear, I don't know what is. Check anger. If you see that person shouting, we'll just say, oh, look at that. She's angry. But excuse me, what the hell do you think is going on? They're having a complete serious mental breakdown. They're having a complete panic attack. That's what anger is. How dare you do that to me? The eyes wide in horror. They will go mad. If that's not fear, I don't know what is. All the delusions, their main flavor is fear. Now, why? Because they're liars. Because we've been believing in their lies for eons. We kind of instinctively, we're living in this constant panic of spending our $5 and the horror of not getting our $50 worth, you know. So there's always this terrible disconnect between how we see things and how they exist. And that's so habitually deep in us. And we just live in all this fear of anxiety, jealousy, depression, anger, low self-esteem. Arrogance, because they're all lies. They are lies. They have no basis in reality. So we're trying to continue to uphold these lies. It's absolutely terrifying. So when we finally have realized emptiness and the subtlety of single-pointed concentration, because you can't possibly realize it with a gross level of mind, you can't possibly realize it with a conceptual state of mind, but we can start there like we're doing here. When you finally cut the root, when you've seen for the first time nakedly that there never has been, isn't, and never could be that fantasy I. That's when you've cut the root and you're climbing out of your samsara into your nirvana. You've got more work to do, but you can't fall back after that. And you are literally fearless. Don't hear it as just romantic. You literally have no fear. So I always love to tell this story about Lama Zopa Rinpoche. He is recognized as a very little boy. He was recognized as the reincarnation of the Lao Tzu Lama, this Nyingma yogi, Khunsang Yeshe, who spent the last 20, 30 years of his life in this cave up in the mountains. He was a Sherpa. And then Lama Zopa is said to be the reincarnation. So he was a tantric yogi, and like all these great tantric yogis, died perfectly with complete control and got his realizations, achieved the realizations at the time of his death, and then chose his rebirth. So since a tiny boy, he was recognized for his unusual behavior. He remembered who he was. And, you know, his mummy, every time she turned her back, she'd find him crawling up the path to the back to the cave where he used to be as a little boy, you know. And from the time he could talk, always every time she turned her back, little Zopa was gone, you know. And then when he could talk, they'd say, come home. He'd say, no, that is my home. So since tiny, he had a clear memory of who he was. And he wanted to get back to his cave and carry on the job. So anyway, at some point, mummy decided she'd better have the lamas check up on him. So they checked up and did their divinations. And they came up with, yes, it seems he is the reincarnation of this Lao Tzu Lama. So anyway, Lama Zopa tells this story about when he was about 8 years old. And he was up in one other monastery many hours up above where he came from, Roa Ling or something. And he was up in this monastery. He was 8 years old, and it was, but it must have been about 1952. So anyway, the story goes something like this. He's told it many times that he across a big river, and the rivers up there are really torrential, I tell you. And he was, there's this strange looking people on the other side of the river. He could see they always have had pale colored eyes, straw colored hair. Clearly they were white people. Sounds like Swedish people. Sounds like Donna. Anyway, he had never met Western people before, and he was very interested. He wanted to meet them, you know. So he decided he'd go across to see them on this rickety bridge, and the bridges up there are very rickety, I promise. And they didn't have sides or anything. So he bought his bowl of potatoes as a gift, right? The Sherpas have their potatoes. And he fell into the river with his potatoes. Well, of course, they don't teach him swimming up there. Never heard of swimming. So he's drowning. And this is how he told the story. He's 8 years old, remember? He said, "Ha, huh, the head," he said, not "I came to the surface for air," but "the head went to the surface for air." I'm going to discuss all this. We'll go through this in the next few weeks. Then he's, and he could see his manager having a panic attack, running along the bank, you know, because he's losing his little tulku. He's having a stroke, you know, this little boy's drowning. And then he kept going down in the water again. And then he said to himself, "Huh, the person known as the Laodo Lama is about to die." And then he said, as a commentary now, "I didn't know anything about emptiness," meaning at that time, 8 years old, he'd heard no teachings about emptiness. But he said, "There was no fear." Now hear this literally, please. Now, this is interesting. Mr. Darwin, wasn't it? Wasn't it Mr. Darwin who came up with the concept of the instinct for survival or something? This whole philosophical view in science that obviously he's correct if he's observed animals and humans. When we're attacked or offended or insulted, it's absolutely true. This panic takes over. And we, of course, assume you need that in order to tell you there's problems so that you know how to respond. Well, Buddha calls that, says that's ridiculous. You don't need stupid fear. That's nonsense. So why is there fear? Because that's the function of ego grasping, the root delusion, which most of the time is like a sleeping lion. But it's when we're severely attacked or offended or insulted or nearly run over by a car, then it wakes up and rises to the surface. And there's this primordial panic of "I am drowning." So we assume that for Lama Zopa to survive, you've got to have this panic. Otherwise, you would sink to the bottom of the river like a stone and go, "Oh, well, I'm drowning. It doesn't matter." No, that's stupid. Buddha, this is a function of ego grasping, because that's the point. Ego grasping is this root delusion that most of the time is like a sleeping lion, but its energy is fear, and its main voices of attachment and anger and jealousy, they're all the voices of this ego grasping, and they are rooted in fear. So it's like, that's why we live in hell. So when you cut the root, Lama Zopa knew automatically from his own past realizations that there never had been, isn't, and could never be an intrinsic self-existent I. So he did not have fear. He wasn't panicking. He was as clear as if he's walking along the street. But he still came to the surface for air, but just out of common sense. But if he had drowned, he would have been peaceful. This is hard for us to conceptualize. It's hard for us to imagine, but that's the Buddha's view. So yes, fear. And to try and imagine being beyond it, it's inconceivable to us. We posit nothing remotely like that in our culture. Any more questions?
No more questions in the chat, Venerable.
Venerable Rubina, I have a question, please.
Good, darling. Talk to me.
Okay. I just wondered if you would talk a little bit. You've been talking about, like, the mistake we make of inherent existence and the mistake we make about attachment. Are those all just kind of mixed together? Like, so we see a inherently ugly prison and then we see an inherent prison. Are those just kind of mushed or layered or?
Yes, they're layered. It's a good one. There's a hierarchy of delusions. These three root delusions, they're the summary of all the thousands of delusions. And they've all got a very intimate relationship with each other. So the root one is this one called ignorance that has the deepest, most primordial misconception of things having an intrinsic nature. Then on the basis of that, there comes, so let's just use ourselves as an example. This deep ignorance believes there is an intrinsic me in here somewhere. And we're going to go into this more depth next week. On the basis of the belief, which is completely instinctive and inarticulate, of the belief in an intrinsic me, then there's this massive emotional hunger, this constant neediness, this constant attachment to get what that me wants. And then when it doesn't get what it wants, then aversion or anger arise. That's the relationship between these three. So like I said before, with the chocolate cake, your eyes see shape and color. Your mental consciousness recognizes chocolate cake. Attachment kicks in that exaggerates the deliciousness of chocolate cake. And that attachment is this emotional hunger. And then because of a habit with chocolate cake, you then invest all this energy. Attachment sees the cake as totally divine. And you totally believe that when I get it, I'll get happiness. That's the energy of attachment. So attachment is a liar insofar as it exaggerates the deliciousness of the cake, but that's informed by the ignorance that's underpinning the attachment that sees, that believes in the intrinsic, in and of itself, delicious cake from its own side. So those lies are utterly linked, and it's layered, yes. The root one is the attachment sees the over-exaggerates deliciousness. The ignorance over-exaggerates the very ontological status of delicious cake and sees delicious cake as existing in there on the plate, having nothing to do with my mind. Do you see?
Yeah, that's helpful. Does it mean then that we should unpeel them in layers? Like, is it easier to unpeel the layer of delicious before we unpeel?
That's the point. That's the whole point. That's what I'm discussing here. The very first level of practice, you've got to abide by the laws of karma first and loosen the grip of the self-pity me that thinks everything happens unfairly. You do that by abiding by the laws of karma. That's junior school. Now you go to high school, so what I've been talking about today, and you start to look into the delusions and attachment and aversion, and you start to realize how they are liars. And this is preparing us to go to the most advanced level where we now get to the root delusion. Absolutely. This is the entire point I'm making. It's gradual. Gradual. Absolutely. That's the point.
Thank you very much. Thank
good, John. Yes. What else, people? 10 more minutes.
Okay. There's two more questions. One of them is, how do you let go of attachment but still have committed, connected relationships or a sense of connection to life?
I hear it. Absolutely. Yeah. It's wonderful. So the problem in the question is there's an assumption in your question that you're talking about something good when you say attachment. So that means when you hear Buddha say you've got to give up attachment, you're also thinking you've got to give up connections. So in other words, you're throwing the baby out of with the bathwater. And that's what we do because we don't have the same definition of attachment as Buddha does. And this is the part that's very difficult for us to hear. We've got a different definition. We mean when we say attach, you're attached to your family, you're attached to your friends. We see it as an equivalent of love. Nothing wrong with that, the definition of attachment, but that's not Buddha's definition. We all know that the same word can have different meanings. This is a crucial point to get and the biggest mistake we make when we hear Buddha's teachings. So we know very well, if you say flat, if you're learning geometry, it means a flat surface. If you're playing music and you hear that a piece is in B flat, you know it's a completely different definition. Same word, same spelling, two completely different meanings. We understand that, but we're very caught up in having our own definition of attachment as being something vaguely like love, which is a virtue. But Buddha's has got nothing to do with it. Attachment in its nature is a monster. If you mainly had attachment and didn't have access to any virtues, you would be what the world calls a psychopath. Please hear my point. We have attachment, but aren't we lucky? It is tempered by the presence of our love and compassion and kindness and goodness and wisdom. We are so fortunate. So the irony is it's harder to see the attachment. But delusions are particular, specific misconceptions that are rooted in nonsense and are deeply disturbing. Virtuous states of mind are in their nature positive, optimistic, valid and reasonable. But we don't have that distinction in our culture, and this is quite hard for us to hear. Attachment, by definition, is what destroys your relationships, because attachment is the voice of ego. It's I want. It only sees what I want. Attachment causes us to see the entire world through the lenses of our needs, and if you don't get your needs fulfilled, you'll turn against that person. So what makes your relationships and your connections useful is love and compassion, not an attachment. That's what destroys them. But we can't see it like that because we have a different definition. That's why it's fundamentally necessary. If we want to understand Buddhism, we need to understand the Buddhist model of the mind, these ones I'm describing. So I hope that helps. What else? Anything else?
I have one, Venerable Rabina.
Yeah.
Cool. Does the mind seek attachment or aversion as a means to reify the existence of an independent self?
I'm a bit lost with that statement.
So in order, if you're attached to something, there has to be a subject that is attached.
Attachment is a state of mind. Let's just say it's Anthony we're describing. Attachment is a state of mind in the person called Anthony's mind. That's it. It's a state of mind. So then go on. Next person.
Does the mind use that as a way to kind of lend credence to the idea of an independently existent self in order for you to be attached?
It's sort of roughly like that, but not really, Anthony. So there's Anthony, and that's the name we give to this combination of a body and a mind. There's body, which has got, you know, noses and ears and blood and atoms. Then you've got your mind, which is not physical, and that's got virtuous states of mind like love and compassion, and it's got negative states of mind, assuming you're an ordinary person, like attachment and anger. So attachment is rooted in the ego grasping, the root delusion, and that's a deep assumption. So attachment is this hunger to get what this fantasy I wants. So then attachment is simply the main function. It's like does the job of the I to get what it wants. But it's all just a misconception because there's no intrinsic I there in the first place. So that's the way to say it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Good, good, good. Fantastic. What else, people?
No,
any more questions?
Not good, darling.
Okay, good. Anybody else? No other questions at all? Yes, Lorna. Good, darling. Talk to me. I can't hear you, darling. Unmute, sweetheart. Unmute, Lorna.
So just for clarification, so attachment is ego getting what it wants because it believes that it will give it happiness.
Something like that sounds pretty good, yes. Attachment is an assumption that when the nice things happen, that'll make me happy. That's a way to put it. But the assumption of the me is the deeper one. But attachment is the voice of this nonsense I that only wants the nice things and hungrily tries to get the nice things. And then when it doesn't get the nice things, we have a panic attack, and that's called aversion. So we run between attachment and aversion 1,000 times a day. When the nice things happen, attachment gets what it wants. We get all excited. And when aversion happens, it's because attachment didn't get what he wanted, and we get all upset.
And so that's also believing the delusion that happiness, we get happiness out there. What is out there will give us happiness, as opposed to cultivating happiness in our mind.
Exactly, Lorna. And this is the part that's really difficult. We haven't begun to discuss this, but we will go into this in more detail. Happiness, and I mentioned briefly before, happiness is just simply a happy feeling, and there's nothing good or bad about that. The more happiness, the better. But our problem is, number one, we believe happiness comes when we get the object, and two, we therefore, you know, and so therefore we even feel that the cake is the happiness. So if you've had a happy day, and I say, how are you, Lorna? And then tell me about your happiness. You're going to describe the nice boyfriend. You'll describe the cake. You'll describe the happy, not the feeling. You'll describe the object, because we are so addicted to the objects. And that's what our memories are. Our memories aren't of happy feelings and unhappy feelings. Our memories are the things out there that we are convinced not only is the cause of the happiness, but we almost think the event is the happiness, because we're so addicted to the external world. But happiness and unhappiness are states of mind. And we're going to go into this next week.
And so because the event is impermanent, it's a fleeting moment in time.
That's right.
That's the emptiness of...
No, no, it's not quite. It's similar. It leads you to see something as impermanent is a good stepping stone to see it as not having an intrinsic nature.
Right.
Not having an intrinsic nature is more subtle.
Right.
But the one
right.
about happy feelings, this is the point. The Buddha's telling us, forget about karma, which we'll also go into next week more, but in order to cultivate happy feelings, we think the only way to do it is to get the cake or the boyfriend. So we're always frantic. But the Buddha's saying, no, the best way to get happy feelings is by having virtuous thoughts, by being loving and kind and practicing generosity and forgiveness. And in general, we know there are some people on the planet who are just, who are always happy because we see that they're kind and generous. And it's because they've practiced that in the past. I mean, even you can see with, say, all the suffering of COVID-19, there's still always going to be some people you read about who, even kids, who think, what can I do to help others? And they go out there and they help others and they're happy. They're not suffering. The ones who suffer, this is all of us, is because you feel depressed, you feel lonely, there's no one to love me, I've got nothing to do, I'm caught up in my house, because that's because of delusions. I mean, it's not to put ourselves down, we've all got them. But virtually, the best way every day to try and cultivate happy feelings is by practicing virtuous thoughts. We're unhappy if you have anger, jealousy, depression, and we obsess about them.
Venerable, you're starting to freeze again.
Because it's all the time. So, this is positive thoughts and unhappy feelings. Okay, unhappy feelings that come when you have negative thoughts. We've got to see that relationship. It's quite powerful, you know. Time to go anyway, Lorna. Time to go. Time to go, Jonna. Time to go, people. We did something anyway. We'll try and see what we can do next week. All our obstacles to hearing these teachings, maybe this means they're going to be beneficial. Let's hope.
Okay.
Jancho of Semchog Rinpoche, Ma Kepanam Keguchig, Kepan Yampa Mepa Yang Gong Ne Gongju Pelva Sho, Gewa Di, Nudu Dag Lama Sange, Drugune, Droa Chikang Malupa, Deyi Sala Gupa Sho. Thank you, darlings. I'm so sorry, the obstacles. But we fitted in. We did most. We did good. There's an advantage in speaking fast sometimes.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Venerable Urbina.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.